RunAsRadio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 188 with guest Alan Sagano, recorded Wednesday, November 24th, 2010. Run As Radio is produced each week by Plop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you very much, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. With me, my co-host, Greg Hughes.
Hey, man. What's going on?
Oh, all is well, my friend. Ready to do some Run As?
Absolutely.
I've been on the road forever doing shows on the field all alone. But now I'm home, you're around, and we get to do one the old-fashioned way.
I've been on the road with a lot of work-related stuff lately, just tends to be last minute. And for once, we're both at our individual homes and able to get together to do it.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Well, one of these days, we'll have to round up some of the stuff you've been doing and make it into a show, because I know it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's interesting, that's for sure.
So our guest today, Alan Sagano, last time here was March of 2009, so it's been a little while. Alan is the president of ADS Consulting Group, founded in 1991, specializes in networking, server virtualization, workstation virtualization, application virtualization, security, Exchange, custom programming, web development, SharePoint, and SQL Server development. Alan, I don't think that's really specialization.
No.
Little bit of everything. But
a little bit of everything. You got to be brought in deep, unfortunately.
Well, that's the truth, right? And of course, virtualization plays a big role. And when we've had conversations in the past, we've talked a lot about the virtualization play. So I pinged you a while back because I've been very interested in the noise, almost anxiousness around ESX, moving to ESXi.
Yes.
So maybe let's tell a story from the very beginning. So this is VMware we're talking about.
Yeah, so I think it was even last year, and I think VMworld of 2009, VMware announced that the direction that ESX is going in is going to be ESXi. And with the latest release of 4.1, VMware has stated that this will be the last release that will include both ESX and ESXi in it. Especially Linux admins, because of the Red Hat shell, the service console that's in the full-blown version of ESX, it kind of freaked a lot of people out. But I can tell you that for most of our clients now, because the announcement's been made, it's kind of the resistance is futile. Let's just get over it and just move to ESXi.
This is a done deal. So they're actually moving away from Linux as a platform?
No, it'll still... You know, they're basically, what they're doing is they're stripping out the service console and they're replacing it with a thing called the Remote Command Line Interface, or RCLI. And the syntax is similar to the commands on the service console. The main difference is the service console is interactive. You can remote into it. It's kind of like, for people that aren't familiar with the service console, it's kind of like a command prompt where you can do different commands. And if you know Linux, the learning curve is not that steep at all. But
wow.
The RCLI is very modal. So you basically issue a command and you wait for the response. You issue the command and wait for the response. So it's a little bit different than the interactiveness of the service console. But unfortunately, with ESXi, there is no service console. So that's going away. Well, there is a hidden service console, but it really doesn't, it's more for troubleshooting and stuff.
And ESXi is a far lighter product. Like, it's dramatically smaller.
Yes, insanely smaller. You know, if you load up the full-blown version of ESX, in terms of memory, it'll take maybe 500 megs, roughly. And ESX, I think the kernel takes like 32 megs. It's ridiculous.
One
of the reasons why they're moving to it is obviously, would they strip out not only the service console, but the web server as well. So the footprint is, you know, shrinks by a factor of, you know, 3 or 4. So the one of the advantages of going to ESXi is it's much more secure because there's less things to screw up.
Yeah, it's just, if you're going to get that small, there's just not a lot of stuff there. It's just a hypervisor.
Yes, it's just pretty much the hypervisor. When you boot to it, the other thing, because it is smaller, it boots a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, it gives you about you know, I don't know, I'm going to have to talk about 8 different options to configure the host. And it kind of does away with, you know, with ESX, there's, I give a talk on virtualization security, and a good chunk of that talk is how to properly secure the service console, how to use, how to use sudo instead of logging in as root, blah, 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 how to configure the firewall. All of that goes away if you use ESXi, because there is no service console, so therefore there is no firewall, because the firewall secures the service console, so you don't really have to worry about the configuration as much. The other thing that's an advantage is there was a new feature released with, I think it's Enterprise Plus, the Enterprise Plus package called Host Profiles, where you could create a golden host image and then basically replicate that and also remediate hosts that don't conform to that golden image. But with ESXi, it's significantly simpler to configure. So the host profiles, although somewhat useful, are not really as big of a deal in ESXi because there's just fewer things to go wrong.
Right.
Also patching, you know, you don't have, because there's fewer things running in ESXi versus the full-blown version of ESX, you know, you're just going to have fewer patches just by the very definition of it because there's fewer things that can go wrong. So.
At least in theory, yeah.
At least in theory, sure. Yeah. We found that, you know, really, yeah, there's not a lot of things you even have to use the RCLI for, especially if you're managing the ESX host now with vCenter, which is something we recommend doing. But the only time that I've actually had to go in to the RCLI out of recent memory was to enable jumbo frames on iSCSI SAN. But other than that, almost everything can be done through the GUI and the vCenter or the vSphere manager. So. You know, you do have to learn the RCLI to some extent, but it's, and the learning curve's not that bad. The thing of it is that you're going to have to learn it anyway. So we're saying, hey, you know, why don't you just get up to speed on it now as opposed to getting shoved into it with the next release of ESX, whether it be, what is it? I don't know if it's going to be 4.2 or 5.0 or whatever it's going to be. You know, it's coming anyway. You might as well get used to it. We found that a lot of times you just don't want to, fight things like that, just accept it and get over it already.
So what is the learning curve, and what are the real changes and the new things that people have to learn if they're used to ESX, haven't seen ESXi yet? What is it that they're going to need to come to speed on?
Yeah, the biggest things are, like I said, the RCLI, but even then you can probably look up the commands you need to do, and the good news there is that you really don't need to pop into the RCLI for many of the things you can just do through the GUI now. So that's the good news. So really the good news here is that you're probably not going to have to go into the RCLI, you know, maybe once in a blue moon. So that's good news. The thing that's a little scary is that if you were relying on the service console for backup, in other words, there was an agent that was running in the service console, you're going to have to rethink that strategy because guess what? There's no service console, so therefore your backup's probably going to break. So you may have to look for a different backup solution that supports ESXi. That is something that we've had to make the adjustment on because we were previously, in order for us to get the VM images, we were using, we were going the budget route and using Symantec's RALIS agent, the remote agent for Linux and Unix servers. You can actually write a script to basically get the VM images and run the agent inside of the service console to get your backups of the VM images for easier restore. But because there's no service console, we actually jumped from that to VRanger Pro, which supports ESXi, so we can get our ESX images. The other downside of that is that we were dumping our images straight to tape, and now we have to actually dump them because VRanger Pro only supports backup to disk. We had to get enough disk space to back up the images to disk, and then we dump them to tape. So it's kind of a two-fold step. There are some advantages by going to VRanger Pro. Probably the biggest one is that it gives you granular restore from a VMDK backup image. So you can back up the VMDKs, but you can restore individual files from the VMDK images using VRanger Pro. And so that's kind of on the plus. The downside is that we had to spring for disk space in order to back up the VMs. And the disks don't have to be super fast, but on the other hand, they kind of have to be decent because, you know, a lot of times if you have a large ESX cluster or even a standalone host, you know, your backup window is with everything else that has to happen. It seems like it keeps shrinking, not getting bigger. So,
well, and VRanger Pro is not free, is it?
It is not free.
Right.
It's licensed by CPU. I think you're looking at about, it's like around $600-$700 per CPU.
Right. So you've had to move from a free backup solution to a pay one, essentially.
Well, Rawlis isn't free either, but it's mostly free.
Right.
Well, sort of. You still have to buy Backup Exec and Symantec. Symantec has a specific ESX agent, but it's really expensive. It's like $3,000. So we went the cheap route, and got the Rawlis agent instead, which is about $200.
Right.
And still allows you to get the image backups. So, but you still have to purchase Backup Exec anyway. And
yeah.
So, and the agents, blah, blah, blah.
Well, and the thing that drives you crazy with these kinds of changes is how many dollars have you committed to a backup solution that isn't complete anymore? And what do you got to do to get the rest?
Right. So we're still actually using Backup Exec to dump our VRanger images to tape. So we are using just the Windows Backup Exec to dump our images, our backup images to tape. So we are still using Backup Exec, but the initial copy from the VMDK images to disk is done via VRanger Pro.
Right.
So that's kind of a big shakeup, and that freaks out a lot of people. You know, it's like, and that was one of the reasons why we were kind of going hemming and hawing. It wasn't necessarily learning the RCLI. It was springing for the extra server and disk space to do the disk space backups.
Yeah, a lot of the time your backup costs, you know, are an offset. It's a risk offset, right? I mean, it's
sure.
An insurance policy. So it's going to be different for every company or every organization.
Yeah, it's just annoying if you've already gone through that process and got a good backup solution working and now it's broken because of this move.
Yeah, so that is definitely a little frustrating. You know, we let's just get over it and do it.
Yeah.
So we actually used our old ESX host as the backup server / vCenter server, and then purchased Sprung for a new ESX server, which is actually really nice. So it has some advantages, I guess.
And this was an ESXi server, I presume.
This is an server is an ESXi server, yes.
So is there any other whammies to migration? I mean, I presume the images just move across.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, images just move across. In fact, we've come across a really cool utility from Veeam. I think it's VEAM called Fast Copy. We were using WinSCP to do our images. Actually, it's called FastSCP, I think. Anyway, we were using WinSCP before to move our images across, and then we came across this utility from Veeam called FastSCP,
mm-hmm.
And it's free, which is always a good price.
Yep, I like that price.
And the main differences between the FastSCP and WinSCP is Fast doesn't encrypt the data as it's copied, so the copies move across a lot faster. Normally, you know, we're already on an internal network, so we don't really care about encryption in this particular case.
Yeah.
We're just caring about, you know, I just need to get the stupid images moved across really quickly.
Yeah, from one machine to another.
If you're on a SAN, it doesn't really matter. If you're running the Enterprise or Enterprise Plus version, you can do a storage migration, which means you can actually move servers from one storage group to another storage group while the machines are hot. So depending on what you're doing, though, in this particular case, because I was moving from one standalone server to another standalone server, I had to actually shut down the machines and move them over with FastSCP.
Okay.
People are going to look for this, I'm sure, and it's not spelled the way you might think it is. It's VEAM.com.
Yeah, it's VEAM. Yeah. So, but yeah, they also have a back solution, by the way, that will work with the ESXi. We haven't had a chance to really look at it, but the word on the street is that it's pretty decent. You know, we definitely like the price of FastSCP because it's free.
Yeah. just for shipping the files around.
Yes, yes. So we typically will load up a vCenter server. We'll just install FastSCP on there because we just know we're going to need it at some point. So that's kind of our standard build now with any vCenter server.
So you just stood up this new server, set up vSphere, got ESXi all prepped, and then just started shipping images across and lighting them up.
Yep, pretty much. You know, with the vCenter server, got visibility from the two ESX hosts and shut down the VMs and said, move this one over, and then just did it and light it up and we're good to go.
Right. And the main thing there was vCenter is able to see everything. So you're able to command from one machine to the next.
Yes. And it didn't really take that long. I was able to move everything over in a weekend and it wasn't really that painful. And the other thing too is the other machine was running, I'm trying to remember if it was running, I think it was running ESX 4.0, mm-hmm. full blown version. So we went from 4 to 4.1 ESXi.
So little differences. Any whammies with the device changes? I'm running into people who have virtual machines that are more bound to the computer than they realized. When they actually try and move them, they break.
Yeah, you got to be a little, that's a really good question. You want to make sure that if you have any direct attached or SCSI pass-through stuff,
right?
You have to be obviously aware of that. That's one thing that we had to actually remove before we moved it. Otherwise, it just complains. You know, moving from the virtual machine hardware on, well, the jump was really from 3.5 to 4.1, but mm-hmm. or 4.0, but you want to make sure that your virtual machine hardware is on version 7. You should anyway, because it's just best practices. It works better. If you do any type of paravirtualized stuff or raw LUN mappings, yeah, that can actually break it as well, which is one of the reasons why we try to keep everything encapsulated in a VMDK. You might take a slight performance hit, but you gain so much in portability and disaster recovery and recoverability, blah, 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 that we think it's just worth it. Some people tout that. I'm like, yeah, you know, you're kind of a little bit theoretically breaking the virtualization paradigm of hardware abstraction at that point. So, which was one of the reasons why we don't do it.
You know, one of the issues I've run into Hyper-V, and this really surprised me, is that it has optimization in the VMs for particular processors. And the consequence is, in a true failover solution where all you've got is the backup, the host machine is dead, if you try and throw that VM onto another machine that's got different processors, it won't work.
Yeah, it'll blue screen sometimes.
Yeah. So like, if you've actually got a mix of AMD and Intel servers, you have to be really careful.
Yeah, which is one of the other, especially in a cluster environment, we always say, if you can, we always recommend keeping the hosts identical. That way, you know for sure you're guaranteed, you know, vMotion or even with Hyper-V, live migration compatibility, and you just don't have to think. I mean, otherwise, if you have different hosts, you have to pull up the CPU compatibility matrix or do CPU masking,
yep.
And then, you know, if it's a Tuesday and things are looking well, you know, you might be able to do it. If not, not so much. So
well, and we've put together backup procedures where we're actually during the backup, flipping the VM into compatibility mode, backing it up, and then flipping it back into performance mode, which is a pain, but at least the backup is portable.
Yes. And even then, when you do it in compatibility mode, you're theoretically taking somewhat of a performance hit.
Yeah. It's about, you know, it's interesting. Do you remember when we were told virtualization was going to solve all this problem with symmetrical hardware clustering? Like, I'm glad we're over that hump, that the lies are now known, and that the good news is, for us old guys, our basic reflexes of buying common machines, of saying, hey, we're an Intel shop, like that kind of mindset, is still serving us today.
Yeah.
Even going to the level of saying, you know what, we are a Dell R710 shop. I mean, literally, that's the way
scary.
Most data centers are run, right? It's like, what are the two sizes of hardware? What's your 1U machine, and what's your little bit bigger machine?
That's one of the differentiators between Hyper-V and VMware, is that for some reason, and I kind of understand where they're coming from. On Hyper-V, you can specify the vCPU that the VM will see.
Yeah.
In VMware, it's just a vCPU. It's a generic vCPU. You don't have the ability, right or wrong, to change the CPU type. And I think that's better because it does allow you to shoot off the lower half of your body if you're not, you know, and other things like if you didn't, if you had to migrate the Hyper-V, if you had to migrate over the VHD to a different platform and you didn't really document what CPU it selected for the VM.
Right.
You're going to be very sad.
Yeah, there's no way to figure it out.
Yeah, well, you've only, you know, you've got 20 choices or whatever.
Yeah.
It's
you're just going to hammer your way through it. Let's try this one. Boom. Yeah. Let's try this one. Boom. Yeah. I haven't run into this, but you got to know there's one you're going to select that's going to work for an hour. And then it's going to blow. Like, don't you know that's going to happen to us, right? Like, if you don't know.
Actually, that only happens to me. Yeah.
Oh, but the other issue, and this is where we started on this whole line here, is what are your real hardware dependencies? What are you actually looking for? And these are tricky because until you actually get into the habit of moving VMs around, you don't know.
Yeah, it is pretty important to document the VM configuration. I mean, it's important on VMware. It's really important on Hyper-V.
And I think one of the things you're finding is that we don't have good documentation built into the VMs themselves. Like they ought to just have a header that tells you everything about them, but they don't.
Yeah, well, if you look at the VMX file or even the config file on Hyper-V, it's just a text file. So you can read that and pretty much figure out what's in the machine should be able to figure it out.
But the specific CPU is not there. Some of this hardware configuration stuff is not there. Like there's key things that are missing.
Yeah, on VMware, there's not, again, you can only do one, it's a generic CPU, so you don't have that challenge that you have on Hyper-V. So, the disadvantage of that is maybe you might not be able to optimize the CPU for whatever it is that you're running, but, you know, hard to say. I know one of the things, we talked about before was trying to figure out sizing on VMs, and that is very, very critical because if you get it wrong, you'll obviously not only impact the VM on that particular VM, but you could potentially grenade all of the other VMs running on the host if you really get it wrong.
Yeah, I've had recent experience with. I think that a lot of people who are working in virtual machines don't really understand what it takes to properly estimate and size. They can do it for hardware, right? I mean, we've all done years and years and years of experience in sizing hardware. But when it comes to doing the virtual machine, what are the mistakes that people make?
Yeah, it's getting a little bit better. One of the things that we always try to push if you're running VMs is get on the X64 platform. Obviously, with Windows Server 2008 R2, there only is an X64 version, so by definition, you're running X64 if you're running 08 R2. But for previous versions, we always say if you can get on the X64 version, and the main reason why is that if you're suffering from crummy VM performance, you might have an out by being able to allocate more memory to that particular VM and just caching everything. We found a lot of times if a VM is running poorly, it's starved for memory. And so we can just give it more memory, cache everything, which releases pressure on disk IOPS and actually even CPU because it doesn't have to manage the disk IOPS anymore. And not only does that VM run better, all the VMs on that host run better. There is a feature called memory overcommit where you can actually allocate more memory to the VMs that's physically available on the host. We're okay doing that maybe on a standalone host if you're allocating maybe 10 to 20% more than the physical memory, but really to get the best performance, you pretty much want to avoid memory overcommit just because you start to, you know, start to rob Peter to pay Paul and the machines are just going to come to a grinding halt.
What do you do or what do you recommend that others do when it comes to sizing out for CPUs or virtual CPUs? A physical CPU versus a VMware or a Hyper-V type machine.
That's a really good question. The basic rule of thumb that we use is we first see if the application itself is SMP or symmetrical multiprocessor compatible. If it is, then we certainly will probably try to bump the vCPUs up from 1 to 4 maybe and see if that helps at all. I can tell you that if for example, on Exchange 2007, not S&P compatible, Exchange 2010 is. So bumping from 1 to 4 on Exchange 2007 buys you almost nothing in a virtual environment. In a virtual environment on Exchange 2010, bumping from 1 to 4 increases the machine by a factor of 2 or 3 in terms of performance. So it really depends on what the application. SQL Server is another good example. Obviously, by default, on any SQL Server app, we'll just give it 4 virtual CPUs right out of the gate just because we know it's going to probably need it anyway, because obviously SQL Server is a pretty intensive, pretty CPU-intensive application. The other rule of thumb also, which is a really critical one, and it's getting harder to do, but it's still possible to do, is you never, ever, ever, ever want to exceed the number of vCPUs versus the physical cores that you have available. It will buy you absolutely nothing. As a matter of fact, it will probably slow it down. So, in other words, if you had a single socketed CPU with 4 cores, you never want to assign more than 4 vCPUs to any VM. Doing 8 or more, any more than 4 will not buy you anything, and it'll probably slow down the machine as opposed to speeding it up. Like I said, that's getting more difficult now because I think AMD even now has a single socketed CPU that's capable of doing 12 cores. It's just insane.
Well, and I've seen this. Intel's producing sample quantities of an X64 processor, compatible processor with 48 cores on the die.
Nice.
Wow.
48 cores.
That is so sick.
It's crazy.
I like it.
Virtual machine environment specialist, either a nightmare or a dream.
Well, my big concern here is the ratio of CPU to memory, because I don't find we're bound by CPU very often. We're bound by memory most of the time.
Yes, that's when in all of my talks that I give, I always say, you know, the first bottleneck you're probably going to run into is memory. You're going to be, especially with some of the newer apps like, you know, Exchange 2010 running, you know, mailbox, client access, system management, and hub transport, just with a baby mailbox store, 16 gig minimum to avoid swapping.
Without a doubt. And a couple of cores is probably enough.
Yeah.
I've been looking at ratios of typically around 4 gigs to the core. But on a 48 core machine like that, I mean, that's 192 gigs just out of the gate.
So now we're saying, you know, for a host, we're looking at machines that can, you know, you might not use it right out of the gate, especially because the higher DIMM densities are insanely expensive still. But, you know, 256. Is probably a good starting point now in terms of, you know, total capacity. Not that you would load it up with 256 out of the gate, but it's maybe not such a bad idea anymore.
Well, because you know eventually these things are going to come down, so it's about how many slots can you put in your server.
Right.
Although the question is, and I don't know if you've ever run into this, Alan, I find an awful lot of places where once the machine is built, I'll never touch it. I'll replace it before I'll modify it in any way.
You know, it kind of is like that. You know, a lot of times what we're finding is what we'll do is when the machine is brand new, we'll fill it up with the lower density DIMMs, knowing that because the higher density DIMMs are too expensive. So in that particular case, we actually are finding that we're upgrading the machine, the memory in the machine, as well as disk space, just because, like I said, we did that for a client just about a month ago. They had a machine that was a little light on memory, so we upgraded them to the 4 gig DIMMs because they all had 1 and 2 gig DIMMs, threw those away and put in the 4 gig DIMMs because the 4 gig DIMMs have come down so much in price that you can actually do it without spending $5 million on it.
Well, and there's bigger than that now, right? I mean, 4 gigs, there's 16 gigs out there that are still pretty pricey.
Yeah, and even the 8 gigs are a little bit better, but again, still pretty pricey.
Well, I think that the issue now is memory is just not keeping up with processors.
Yes. Yeah, and that's another reason why you want to look for a host today. We're saying, you know, 256 gig of RAM, potential memory capacity. Not that you would use it out of the gate, but it sounds like a lot today, but, you know, when you start talking about 48 core processors, you know, it's borderline ridiculous. The other gotcha in all of this, and we've already run across it even with the new AMD 12 cores, and I don't know what VMware's stance on this is, but for a lot of their packages, when they sell it by socket, the maximum number of cores you can have is 6.
Wow. In a given VM.
This is actually, because you know how on VMware, they typically charge standard, advanced, enterprise, and enterprise plus packages. They charge by physically socketed CPU.
Right.
So the problem is that those socketed CPUs, they typically have a maximum core of 6. So in other words, if you bought a single socketed CPU that happened to have 12 cores, you would actually have to buy 2 socketed CPUs in VMware to support the single 12-core socketed.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I don't know what's going to happen with there, if they're going to adjust their pricing or whatever.
They're gonna have to, this is a licensing issue, not a technology
issue. It's a licensing issue, yeah. But it's a... We were looking at that, and one client wanted to use the new 12-core AMD processors. They actually ended up going with the Intel processors that had 6 cores, precisely for that reason,
right?
Because they would have got barbecued on the VMware licensing.
I just poked around Kingston. I couldn't help myself to look at the pricing on RAM right now, and the 8 gigs are about $500, and the 16 gigs are $1,400.
Mm.
So 16s are still punitively expensive.
Yeah, so they're triple the price as opposed to double.
It's supposed to double for the capacity. Yeah. So therein lies the battle, right?
Yes.
And goodness knows what if and when we can get 32s, how much they're going to cost.
Yeah, and it would be $1 million.
Millions! Well, Alan,
come out.
What's next for you, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing a virtualization security class in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
The first or second week of December, and then I'll be at Wind Connections and Tech Mentor in Florida and Orlando in the spring.
I'll be there.
And you will.
Yep.
Well, excellent. We'll have to come by and say hi.
For sure.
And and then I'm also doing a virtualization conference specific that's kind of tied toward, it's tied to the Windows IT Pro magazine. That'll also be, I think, in March or something like that. So those are the things that are coming up, as opposed, and also trying to keep our clients happy, which is always a never a dull moment.
Well, otherwise they wouldn't pay us.
Yes.
Alan, thanks so much for talking to us.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.